From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And the Trump administration infrastructure plan is finally out. The headline number is $1.5 trillion, but only $200 billion of that would come from the federal government over a decade. Cities, states, and private investment would make up the rest. Joining us now with his thoughts is former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, a Democrat and founder of the group Building America's Future. That's a bipartisan coalition focused on U.S. infrastructure investment. Governor, welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
And what are your initial reactions to the Trump administration's infrastructure plan?
Well, it's a joke. There is no plan. American Society of Civil Engineers says to get our infrastructure back to fair condition, we have to spend $2 trillion in the next 10 years above what we've been spending. The Trump plan only devotes $200 billion, that's $20 billion a year, to the infrastructure revitalization. That's 10% of what the American Society of Civil Engineers recommends. And they're not doing it with new revenue. They're doing it by cutting other parts of the budget. So we're not even sure that they'll get the $20 billion a year on a yearly basis. So it's a joke. It also changes the level of state contribution, which used to be 20% state, 80% federal. It changes that to, it flips it, 20% federal and 80% state. States just are not going to be able to take advantage of even this limited amount of money. It does virtually nothing to help infrastructure development, and it's very disappointing. The president during the campaign said he was going to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure. He's not doing that. He's spending 20% of that. The president said he was going to do big projects. There's practically no money in there for big projects. It's a joke. They can spend $341 million giving a tax cut to real estate developers, which they just did, and yet only spend $200 billion on infrastructure that affects every American. It's a cruel hoax.
Well, the administration believes, or they say, that they'll be able to leverage private dollars to help out with this. Do you buy that?
Well, they may be able to leverage some private dollars, and they did some things like removing the state ban on tolling that will help that. But let me give you an example. We have 60,000 structurally deficient bridges in America. I would say about 100 of them generate enough traffic to be tolled. And, of course, you have to have a toll or a tax to get private investment because private investors want a return on their investment. And that makes sense. It's common sense. So for 100 bridges, you might be able to do it with an infusion of private sector money. But for 59,900 other bridges, it's government, and I mean local, state, and federal government, that bear that responsibility.
The plan calls for $50 billion specifically for rural infrastructure projects to be given as block grants. What do you think about that part of it, and what kind of projects do you think are needed in rural America right now?
Well, some places in rural America have a heavy need, like Montana and the Dakotas, because that's where the natural gas has been discovered, and so there's a lot of trucking needs. But generally, there are not big projects in rural areas. I think that money was thrown in just for political purposes.
We'll see if there's any money in this for trains and rail projects around the country. But I wonder what you think about the fact that people have looked at what's been going on in New York City, specifically where they've actually added to their subway, and it ends up costing way more than it does to add subway lines in other places. Is part of the problem that our costs are just so high in this country for infrastructure?
Well, yeah, that's true. And costs are high where there's the great demand. In New York and Philadelphia and a couple of other American cities, construction is going on at a frenetic pace. But it's not going to get any better. Ronald Reagan, when he raised the gas tax, and yes, listeners, Ronald Reagan raised the federal gas tax. When he did so, he said, why would we wait 5 or 10 years from now to do what's necessary, because it'll only be more expensive then?
What do you think about the Trump administration idea of shortening the permitting process for infrastructure projects? Will that make a difference?
It's a good idea. It will be helpful, but it won't make a difference. Look, you cannot do infrastructure revitalization on the cheap. And remember, these are assets we're building. For example, the Hoover Dam, a huge infrastructure project, was done by this country in the 1930s. Is the Hoover Dam still working to provide electricity to the area that it's located in? Yes, it is, almost 90 years later. Infrastructure produces assets that have long-term value. We should treat it differently than ordinary spending.
If you were to design an infrastructure plan right now, what would the most important projects be?
Well, projects that involve public safety. We've got dams that are structurally unsafe. We've got bridges that are structurally unsafe. We've got pipelines that are structurally unsafe. Those are the things we've got to get to first. Then the next thing is things that have economic competitiveness that can help our economy, that can create jobs. Only about a fourth of our ports on the East Coast are dredged deeply enough to receive the big Panamax liners that are coming through the expanded Panama Canal. So we're losing a lot of longshoreman jobs and trucker jobs to Canada, where the ports are ready to receive that type of cargo. So public safety first, economic competitiveness second would be the drivers.
One more thing. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on the White House response to the staff secretary, Rob Porter, leaving after two of his ex-wives publicly accused him of domestic abuse.
Well, it's confusing. When this first came out, General Kelly praised him. That was on Tuesday. He praised him again on Wednesday. And now he's claiming that as soon as he knew about this, he fired him. Well, that's just not credible. I mean, they've known about it. The guy hasn't had a security clearance. Wouldn't the chief of staff know why a person in that key position didn't have a security clearance? The president's reaction to this has been hugely disappointing. He's expressed sympathy on two or three occasions for Mr. Porter, but has never expressed even a shred or an iota of sympathy for the victims. And the victims, you saw those pictures and you heard those descriptions of what Mr. Porter did to them. That's brutal. And I don't know where the president's priorities are.
Should Kelly resign?
I don't know whether he should resign. I think he has made a mess of things. He hasn't been a good servant to the president. If the president didn't know about this and General Kelly didn't tell him, if I were president, he would be gone in 2 seconds.
That's Ed Rendell, a Democrat who was the governor of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Okay, let's check in on the Olympic Games. NPR's Russell Lewis is in Pyeongchang. He joins us now. And Russell, the big story today was the wind. It forced the cancellation of the women's giant slalom, and it made for some scary moments in the women's slopestyle finals when those snowboarders were way up in the air making huge jumps. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, you know, these pesky winds have been around here for a few days now, and it really is starting to bedevil Olympic organizers. You know, for the second day in a row, they've had to cancel a marquee event. First, it was the men's downhill. Then it was the women's giant slalom. It's not unusual for events to be canceled in the Olympics. It happens every now and then. You know, they sort of build it in at the beginning. And one thing that Olympic organizers are saying at this point is that at least this is happening at the beginning of the games, not the end. They've still got some time to try to squeeze everything back in.
Yeah, well, tell us about what happened with the slopestyle finals. American Jamie Anderson won her second gold medal, even though she fell because of those winds.
Yeah, and she wasn't the only one. You know, most of the competitors were falling. It was a pretty windy day. As we understand it, as we hear from some of the athletes, that they were sort of feeling the pressure from Olympic organizers to try to get this, to try to get it in and finish today. It was a little bit messy. And certainly, you know, you heard from some of the athletes that were a little bit frustrated that they felt like that they probably shouldn't have been running on the slope style. But, you know, in the news conference today, Jamie Anderson was all smiles, and you know, she was saying, you know, it was a gold medal performance, I guess.
All right, gold for her, a bronze for the U.S. in team figure skating. They couldn't catch up to Canada and the Russian skaters.
No, you know, and it was, you know, despite some near flawless performances from Mirai Nagasu and Adam Rapan, who basically nailed their performances in their individual portions of the team figure skating competition. You know, it seems that the Americans were content for a bronze. They would have liked to have had either a gold or a silver, but at least that they medaled. And it's really, in many respects, is a warm-up for the individual competitions which are coming up later here in the Olympics.
Yeah, that program by Nagasu when she became the first U.S. woman to land a triple axel in Olympic competition, that was an amazing thing to see. Of course, Russell, there's more than just games going on. We've got politics. Kim Yo-jong, the sister of the North Korean leader, has gone home, but she made some news first.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's as we've been chronicling over the past couple of days, she had a whirlwind weekend here in South Korea. She had this diplomatic offer to have the South Korean president meet with her brother later this year, and it sounds like that may happen. Some people are saying, you know, is it just sort of partly show? That is this just sort of Olympics goodwill that you often see at the Olympics, or is this going to be something that's going to be lasting, or is this just a temporary thing?
All right. NPR's Russell Lewis in Pyeongchang. Russell, thank you.
You're welcome.
The UN's regional coordinator for Syria said today that Syria is witnessing some of the worst fighting of the seven-year-old conflict. Over the weekend, Israel attacked Syria's air defense system after one of its fighter jets was shot down by a Syrian missile. Joining us now is NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. He's in Washington now, but just back from Syria. Hi, Tom.
Hey, good to be with you.
Good to have you. And what does this Israeli military action say about the state of the conflict in Syria right now?
Well, I think what it says is we're going from proxy forces around the country to actual powers, large powers actually moving in. The Israelis hit a base in Palmyra where the Iranians were based. And, of course, in the north, we have Turkey going after the Kurdish fighter supported by the U.S. And then farther to the east, southeast, we have Russian-backed forces, pro-Syrian regime forces moving on U.S.-supported rebels and the U.S. Mounting airstrikes, horrific airstrikes that killed 100 of those forces. So it's all the main forces sort of moving in now. It's much more different than it was just a few weeks ago.
But one of the forces that we hadn't heard much about before this is Israel. How involved are they in Syria at the moment? They don't have any troops on the ground.
They do not. And their concern is the Iranian-based militias starting to move toward Israel. There was a drone, Israel said, that was moving into their territory, and the Israelis struck back. And then one of their fighter aircraft actually crashed as a result of this fighting going on. And I'm told it was the first crash of an Israeli warplane since 1982.
So you're just back from Syria yourself. First of all, where did you go and what did you see?
Well, we went to just north of Dar Azor, which is sort of the front line against ISIS now. The U.S.-supported Syrian Democratic Force is pushing south along the Euphrates River down to the Iraqi border to sort of clean out the last vestiges of the Islamic State Caliphate. So we were just north east of there, and then we went up to Raqqa, which was taken back, months ago.
And, from ISIS.
From ISIS, right. That was, of course, their headquarters of their caliphate. And then we went north of there to Manbij, which was taken back from ISIS 16 months ago. So it's really a bustling city now. And it's also where the U.S. is facing Turkish-backed forces, and they're taking pot shots at both the Kurdish fighters and the U.S. Several times a week.
Well, you spoke with Lieutenant General Paul Funk, who's in charge of the anti-ISIS fight in Syria and Iraq. Let's listen to what he told you.
Anytime our soldiers are threatened, it worries me. But they're pretty good at what they do, and they will defend themselves.
So if it's a serious threat, they'll shoot back?
Yes, they will.
How challenging is the conflict right now for the American troops who are still deployed in Syria?
I don't think it's that much of a challenge. There's a concern that General Funk just mentioned that these American troops are moving along these checkpoints run by the Kurdish fighters and concerned that these pro-Turkish forces are shooting at them. This is mostly harassing fire. And President Erdogan of Turkey said they may move on Manbij and clearly that's where, you know, scores of U.S. troops are. So that's a huge concern for General Funk and others. But again, you have to remember that the U.S. is assisting and training and aiding these Syrian Democratic Forces. They're not really doing the fighting themselves, and they call in airstrikes and so forth. So it's not really like American troops are on the front lines, except for this area that we just mentioned in Manbij. So they are doing, again, the cleanup. They estimate it'll take 2 to 6 months to clear out the final parts of the Islamic State Caliphate. And then it's really a political issue. People told me last fall that, Tom, you know, once the Islamic State Caliphate comes to an end, the hard part begins. Does this country break up? What's the future? And again, this is going to be going on for months, if not years.
And here's another possibility, which is that ISIS is resurgent in Syria. Is that possible, that they might take back some of the territory that they've lost?
Probably won't take back some of the territory, but they have scooted away from the Syrian Democratic Forces. They've moved north into Turkey. They've moved to the west into the Russian-Syrian-controlled area. And some have moved into Iraq. Actually, the leader of the Islamic State, Baghdadi, we're told he was wounded in an airstrike and was bedridden for some time. And now they believe he is somewhere in the desert, maybe in Syria, in the eastern part of the country, or even into Iraq. So they are on the move. Will they be able to mass and pose a serious threat? That's doubtful. But the real concern now is when the caliphate comes to an end, I think, is what do they do in Turkey? And how many of them move up into Europe to join the cells already in Europe?
Is there anything that sticks out in your mind, an image from your recent reporting trip there?
I think two images. The devastation in Raqqa is just something I've never seen before. I think you have to look at the pictures of the destruction of World War II in Hamburg and Dresden to get any sense of what Raqqa looks like. It is completely and utterly destroyed. Just mile after mile of buildings collapsed. And then every once in a while, you'll see a little shop there selling chicken sandwiches. We went to one that actually stayed open throughout the ISIS time and actually sold sandwiches to ISIS. The last image, I think, is in Manbij. The girls are starting to go back to school now. ISIS forced everyone to wear black. You couldn't wear any colors. We walked into this high school class, all girls, in bright colored hijabs, pinks and purples and reds. And a lot of them said they're studying English. And we asked, how many want to go to university? And almost every hand went up.
That's NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman, just back from a trip to Syria. Tom, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, nearly a million caribou live in the state of Alaska, but in the rest of the U.S., caribou are hard to find. There is one struggling herd on the border of Idaho and Washington State, and this winter, a group of biologists, tribal members, and volunteers are trudging through forests there to collect the caribou's favorite food, lichen, as part of a last-ditch effort to boost the herd's numbers. Emily Schwing from the Northwest News Network has more.
The herd is called the South Selkirk Mountain Caribou. The animals live in a mountain range that stretches across the U.S.-Canada border into northeastern Washington State and the Idaho Panhandle. In the winter, they head for the mountains and feast on lichen that hangs from tree branches. To be clear, this caribou herd is tiny.
Today, these are the last 11 that occupy habitat in the lower 48.
That's Ray Entz, a biologist. He also directs the wildlife program for the Kalispell Indian Tribe.
Once these 11 caribou are gone, it's over for the United States.
So the Kalispells joined forces with other tribes, wildlife management agencies, and conservation groups on both sides of the border to build an 18-acre maternity pen in British Columbia. Shepherds have been hired to watch over the herd. If all goes well, that's where between 5 and 8 pregnant caribou will give birth this spring, away from the threat of predators. The goal is to help the herd grow. The challenge is feeding those pregnant animals once they're in the pen. Enter Cheryl Moody.
I am the executive director of the Selkirk Conservation Alliance.
There's a row of hammocks hanging from wall to wall in the garage at Moody's North Idaho home. Hammocks, the kind you'd hang between two trees and lounge in with a good book or a beer. But on this day, they're full of stringy, crunchy, dried out, bright green lichen, exactly the kind mountain caribou love to munch on.
It looks like hair. It looks like pea green hair.
many people are familiar with this. People mistake it for moss frequently, but as kids, we called it witch's hair or goat's beard.
My dad used to hang it out of his nose as a joke.
Well, there you go.
But this is no joke. This is part of one last effort to save what remains of mountain caribou here in the lower 48. And so here is Cheryl Moody, elbow deep in lichen, that she and other volunteers have collected by hand from tree branches for most of the last year.
When we use the poles to pull the lichen down off the trees, we get a lot of small sticks, pine needles, other debris.
Lichen is high in protein and nutrients and readily available in the winter when other plants are not. And biologist Ray Entz says pregnant caribou eat tons of it.
Yeah, it's like 38 pounds per day per animal.
Lichen weighs virtually nothing, and this crew has to gather between 150 and 250 pounds of the stuff, hang it, dry it, and clean it by early March.
This 250 pounds of lichen is just to sustain those animals over that first 10 days, so they're weaned off of lichen and onto pelletized food. And then as they're released, the snow melt makes available their regular diet of buds and leaves and things from shrubbery and forbs.
This is the first year a maternity pen has been used to help the South Selkirk herd, and says they're the most critically endangered mammal species in North America. That's why he and other volunteers are trying so hard to save them.
I don't care if we fail. If we try everything and anything to recover caribou and they don't make it, I'm okay with that. But if we just sit back and let them go when we had an opportunity to interject and recover this species and we didn't do it, I can't live with that.
If the caribou and their calves do well in the maternity pen this spring, wildlife managers could help boost the herd's numbers in future years with caribou from Canada. For now, people like Cheryl Moody will keep gathering and cleaning lichen because the last caribou in the contiguous U.S. aren't gone yet. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Schwing.
You've probably heard about this Russia investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Every day there's a new headline about it. Well, Embedded is back with two episodes that lay the whole thing out, start to finish, so the news makes sense. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
It takes years of training to compete with a skill on display at the Winter Olympics in South Korea. But there are other athletes already working toward the next Olympics, the 2020 Summer Games in Tokyo. Here now's Alex Ashlock reports.
Every February, the New Balance Indoor Track Meet brings the world's best runners to Boston. Christian Coleman, who beat the great Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt in the World Championships last year, won the 60-meter dash Saturday night. And Jenny Simpson, who snared a bronze medal in the 2016 Olympics, sped past the rest of the field to win the 3,000-meter race. The 2020 Tokyo Olympics are still 2 years away, but Coleman and Simpson are good bets to be there. And they just might have a teammate in another runner who competed on Saturday night, 27-year-old Emma Coburn. She became a world-class runner almost by accident.
I started running because my older brother and sister signed up for the track team, and I just wanted to be like them.
That was back in grade school in Crested Butte, Colorado.
My brother signed up for track, and he luckily signed up to be a distance runner. And so had he signed up to be a thrower, I'm sure my sister would have signed up to be a thrower, and I would have signed up to be a thrower, and my career would be a lot different.
Emma Coburn! Looking at the world championship! Emma Coburn's going to be the world champion!
In London last summer, Coburn did something no American woman had ever done. She won the world championship in the 3,000-meter steeplechase.
The steeplechase is strange, but I think it's a great mix of endurance, athleticism, and coordination, and drama. You know, it's a very exciting event.
The steeplechase has its origins in Britain, where racers ran from church steeple to church steeple. Today, they circle the track and have to clear 28 barriers and 7 water jumps. There's no way you don't get wet. Coburn came to this unique race, just as she did her entire running career, by chance.
My family and I were going to Albuquerque from Colorado, driving down there for a race, and I was signed up for the 800. And my dad thought, we're not driving 8 hours for you to run 2 minutes. So he looked at the schedule, and the only event that I could double enter in was the steeplechase. So I tried it, and I ended up qualifying for high school nationals.
Coburn became an 8-time state champion in high school. That led to NCAA championships at the University of Colorado and the Olympics in London in 2012 and Rio in 2016. She won a bronze medal in Brazil. Those were all milestones in a career Coburn never really imagined when she signed up for that track team back in grade school.
I didn't even know that you could run in college on a scholarship, and then once I got to college, I didn't even know you could be a professional at it and make money at it.
Today, as a professional runner, Coburn wants to help younger runners find their way along the path that she has followed, with so much support from her family and coaches. She and her husband started a 5K road race in her hometown, Crested Butte, to raise money for a cancer charity, and she wants to inspire young girls to stay active.
Through sport, I gained a lot of confidence, a lot of positive body image ideas instead of negative, and I just always try and encourage young girls to participate and push both their physical and kind of mental limits through sport.
It seems to be working. After her race Saturday night, Emma Coburn was surrounded by young runners posing for selfies and signing autographs. Paying it forward. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
Connects to land, the road moves on to sea. The promise that they hold is joint prosperity.
That's a promotional video for the biggest infrastructure initiative on Earth at the moment. It's China's Belt and Road Project, also known as One Belt, One Road, and it aims to redraw the map of global trade. The plan's name references the historic Silk Road, which once connected China to the West. Belt and Road is a trillion-dollar plan spanning dozens of countries, and all this week, we're going to take a look at its impacts around the world. Joining us to get started is NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Beijing. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Jeremy.
And this idea of One Belt, One Road, this was announced by President Xi Jinping back in 2013. What is the vision here?
The basic idea, Jeremy, is that openness and connectivity among countries promotes prosperity and causes countries to flourish. And on the other hand, isolation causes stagnation and backwardness. And Xi Jinping spoke about this starting in 2013 and also at a forum in Beijing about One Belt, One Road last year. And he evoked images of the Silk Road, particularly 1,000 years ago during the Tang Dynasty, when China was at its most cosmopolitan, its most open, its most connected to Europe and the rest of the world, that, this is what's needed and China is going to provide it.
And this is a trillion-dollar initiative, right?
That's right, but it's still very, very early in the game. It's going to take decades to see big results from this project, yet they've already achieved a lot. They've gotten 71 countries to sign up. And it's gaining momentum, and as it does, more countries want to join. And they're building up institutions to pay for all this, such as the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and something called the Silk Road Fund. And, you know, within China, they've really made it a national priority. They've even written it into the Communist Party's constitution.
And what is the belt and what is the road?
Okay. Basically, it's a connection of different projects. Basically, they come together in one overland route, and that goes – it's like a series of roads and rails that leads from western China through Central Asia, through Turkey, and into Europe. And then there's another maritime route that goes down China's east coast through Southeast Asia, the Indian Ocean – the Arabian Ocean, and all the way to Africa, then through the Suez Canal into the Mediterranean and that way to Europe. And both of these routes do have historical precedents. They were in operation for centuries.
So what kinds of projects are they building as part of One Belt, One Road? Is it mostly roads, train tracks, things like that, or are there other pieces of this as well?
Yeah, well, actually, a lot of these projects were conceived before they were included into One Belt, One Road. And a lot of these are already up and running. These rail lines to Europe are carrying freight from China all the way to the UK. They've also got something that's very important to China, which are energy pipelines that go through Myanmar and Pakistan into Western China, which is the less developed part of the country. And the ports, they've invested billions of dollars in ports in countries including Sri Lanka. There's a port there called Hambantota. And also the port of Piraeus in Greece is now managed by China. And they've also got another massive leg of this project that's underway. It's a pan-Asian railway that's going to go out of southwest China through Laos, Thailand, down the Malay Peninsula, all the way to Singapore.
And that's actually not far off, right? They're going to have that done within a matter of years.
That's happening, yeah. It's being built now, and it's going to be operative in a few years.
And how are they going to pay for all this? I guess maybe that's a stupid question because I feel like China's got all the money that they need right now. But is it difficult to spend all this?
No, China does have the money to fund. Its government coffers are packed. And basically, the big thing to remember here is that China is now a net exporter of capital. It used to be the place where companies went to invest to make things, to set up factories and make iPods and sneakers and all that stuff. Now China has the money, and it is seeking better returns by investing it overseas in infrastructure.
Does China face any opposition as it gets these projects going in different countries? Are the countries all saying, oh, yes, great, more infrastructure investment here, or are they more skeptical?
Well, the thing is that a lot of these projects have hit snags in Thailand, in Sri Lanka, Myanmar, Pakistan. In some cases, the financing deals have left these countries in a lot of debt. In some cases, they've used Chinese workers and material and not the local stuff. In some cases, there's been a lack of environmental impact assessment. All of these have led to charges that China is practicing neocolonialism. There's a lot of mistrust of China's intentions. Some countries look at the way China suppresses dissent at home, and they fear that China is exporting some sort of illiberal world order. Now, China knows this, and it's trying to allay all these concerns. It says it will not follow in the footsteps of Western colonial powers, and it will not force its development or political models on other countries. And I think if the deals go well, then people's suspicions will be eased. But you have to remember that, you know, China is new to this sort of global infrastructure building, to doing financing in a transparent way, to working with civil society in all these countries. China's learning curve is going to be steep.
And have there been any security concerns anywhere in the world so far?
Absolutely. One thing that's of great concern is that these infrastructure projects, roads and rails, in some countries, particularly Pakistan and Myanmar, go through places where there are ethnic insurgencies. There are civil wars going on. And in Pakistan and Myanmar, there have actually been attacks either on the projects themselves or the companies that run it. And this is of great concern to everybody because, you know, this raises, you know, the problem of providing security for this. And how is China going to provide security? Is it going to start sending in, you know, security contractors? Is it going to send in its military? Nobody is quite sure how this is going to play out. So that is another area of concern.
Who is not part of this? I was looking at a tweet from the former Treasury Secretary in the United States, Larry Summers, who said, for the first time since World War II, the USA is not leading or even participating in the leading global integration initiative of the moment. It is surely China's One Belt, One Road project. You can't shape what you stay apart from. Historic error.
That's right. A lot of countries have felt that way. Countries that were sitting it out, that were sort of watching and waiting. Japan was one of them. They decided it would be better to be in on it, so they joined. India is a big country that has so far sat and watched. They have a dispute with China, and that is the economic corridor and pipeline through Pakistan runs through the disputed territory of Kashmir. So they're not willing to participate in that. And the U.S. has had concerns, but it was sort of caught off guard by a lot of its allies and partners, including the U.K., getting in on it. And also, the U.S.'s own businesses have seen opportunities to make money, and they want in, too. So it turns out that the U.S. sent a delegation to the Belt and Road Forum in Beijing last year and expressed openness to participation.
How do Chinese people feel about all of this Chinese money being spent overseas?
You know, Jeremy, because this has become a huge national priority, you sort of can't escape it in China. It's in everything. It's been written into the Communist Party's constitution. It's raised at almost every official event. But aside from a bunch of experts, a lot of Chinese are not really aware of what's going on and the issues involved. Some who are sort of feel that, you know, China is still not that developed in a lot of places, and this money should be invested in raising people's living standards at home. But everyone's heard of it. It's just that it hasn't really affected a lot of people in their daily lives yet.
That's NPR's Beijing correspondent Anthony Kuhn starting us off in our week-long series about the One Belt, One Road project. Anthony, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy.
And our series continues all this week from Myanmar, Kenya, Kazakhstan, and the Netherlands. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at China's investment in Pakistan.
People are quite looking forward to the economic boom that it might cause. There are already 10,000 Chinese working on a China-Pakistan corridor project.
That's tomorrow on Here and Now, and you can find all our stories about Belt and Road at hereandnow.org.
It's Here and Now with a sample of the voices you're hearing on our show today.
You know, it's something that our employees actually recognize.
Well, it's a joke. There is no plan.
It's still very, very early in the game.
Yeah, you know, these pesky winds have been around here for a few days now, and it really—
Notice anything? They were all men. We counted the voices by gender and found that only about 30% of the sources featured on our show today are women. The imbalance is a problem across media outlets on any given day. Ed Yong, a science reporter for The Atlantic, noticed it in his work 2 years ago, and he's been trying to make some changes. Ed, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
What made you think you had a problem when you started looking into this back in 2016?
So this was actually inspired by my colleague Adrian LaFrance at The Atlantic, who did an analysis of her own reporting and found that only about a quarter of the people she was quoting and talking about in her stories were women. And she did this 2 years running and found the same ratio. So she, through doing that, inspired me to do the same analysis of my own work, and I found the same proportion, so about a quarter. And that was concerning. You know, I think of myself as someone who cares a lot about equality and who supports women in science, but clearly I was part of the problem. I was contributing to this world in which the contributions of women in science and in the media are undervalued. So I really wanted to fix that. So I spent 2 years trying to actively find a greater diversity of sources, so more women to contact for my stories. And crucially, I tracked down how I was doing in a spreadsheet. So for every story I write, I note how many men and women are quoted in the story, how many men and women I contact for quotes in the first place. And that really allowed me to, in the piece I wrote for The Atlantic, vaccinate myself against self-delusion.
And what was the ratio when you first counted?
When I first counted, it was 25%. So a quarter of the people who were quoted in my stories were women. And that I managed to raise that to 50% within about 4 months, and it stayed there ever since. So, Wow. You know, in any given month across my stories, half the people I quote will be women.
Well, I mean, you've made the point already that that ratio is not unusual. We actually went back and looked at our show. In the past week, we found that 64% of our sources were male, of course, 35% female. NPR also went back and looked at this and found that 30% of their sources in 2015 were female. So, you know, it's not just Ed Yong at The Atlantic. It is an entire system. Why do you think it's happening?
You know, I think it's to do with wider societal biases in our pool of available sources. So in science, there are huge systemic biases that favor men over women in all sorts of areas, from, you know, from the people who get a chance to do science in the first place, to job hiring, to getting invitations to speak at conferences. So, you know, men are just more out there. And I think it takes active effort to resist that. You know, I think that journalism shouldn't just be a mirror to society. I think that in reporting on the world, we also manifest that world. And we have a responsibility to I think, also show the world as we would love to see it. And to me, that is a world in which men and women have equal opportunities and an equal voice in the stories that we tell about the world.
Well, it is pervasive. I find sometimes that when I ask a woman for an interview, she will defer to her male colleague, or she might say something like, I'm not the one who knows the most about this. Let me suggest you talk to this person. And often that is a man. Do you experience that?
I've experienced that some. So I think there is a bit of this reticence to put yourself forward. Now, I'm not convinced that that is a problem that women need to fix. It's often portrayed that way, but maybe it's a problem of men being too eager to like venture out of our lane and speak on topics that we right. don't actually have that much expertise about. Now, how do you go about fixing this? One person who responded to the piece I wrote at The Atlantic, a journalist named Sue Llewellyn, said that she now changes the way she approaches people. So rather than saying like, I would like you to comment on something, she says, I would love you to share your expertise on something. So it's kind of empowering sources who might be reticent to come forward with their expertise, which I know that they have.
And it goes beyond journalism, because a couple of years ago, I counted the authors that I read over the course of a decade, because I happen to keep a list of that. And I was shocked when I found that only 15% of the books that I read were written by women. And I spent the last few years since then trying to change that. I'm much closer to 50-50 now than I was before. And I think you are getting at something here, which is that if you try, there is hope to change.
Right. Actually, it doesn't take a huge amount of effort. You know, it's taken a bit of effort to find more female sources, but it's not been like a massive burden on my work. And you're right that I think this applies to everything. It applies to the books that I read, the people who I follow on Twitter, the, you know, the speaking engagements that I choose to take up. Like all of these aspects of, especially our role in the media, our role as gatekeepers, we have a huge responsibility at who we're putting out in all these various formats and avenues.
And I acknowledge, I know we're going to hear from people when they're listening to this. We are two men talking about this. So there we go. That gender imbalance continues. But Ed Young covers science for The Atlantic. Thanks for speaking with us about this.
No, thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.